This is The After Party, live with Kim McAllister. Pick a couch, grab a drink, and settle into the conversation.
The After Party, live on a Friday. Love it. Thank you for being here. It is The After Party Live, and I have some good stories for you. Also want to let you know it's Tim Seca Friday. So I love to hear what Michael Snyder has to say on The Mark Thompson Show, and then what Tim Seca has to say on The After Party Live, and kind of compare the two. It's always good to get a lot of information when you're talking about movies and movie reviews. And plus, I love to talk about all that stuff anyway. There are a couple of bigger stories that I wanted to talk to you about. But before we get started, I'm hoping that you can click the like button. And if you haven't subscribed, please subscribe to the show. Really trying to get to the 2,000 subscriber mark. And I know that's not a lot. When you look at The Mark Thompson Show, which I've been remiss in mentioning, we hit 31,000 subscribers on The Mark Thompson Show. So that show is growing and growing quickly. This show growing a little slower. That's all right. You know, it's a show where we kind of do the offbeat news and sciencey stuff and things that are of interest, I think. But we've already talked about politics and we've already talked about the news of the day. So after the Nicki Maduro show, in whatever length it may be, or the Mark Thompson show, which is a 2-hour long show, I figure by that time, we're ready for something a little different. That means that the show, maybe, I don't know if it has as wide of an appeal or if people just don't know about it or what have you. So it's growing a little slower. So thanks for helping me share the shorts and the short videos that are posted on YouTube and help me grow the show. I really appreciate that. You can also contribute by finding the PayPal link. It is at the bottom of the show description. Also, it's in the about. If you click on the After Party Live, what's the show about? It's in there too. So thank you for supporting this little show that we're trying to keep on the air, on the YouTube air, as it were. Let's still talk about what happened in San Francisco. Adam Schiff. He had his bag stolen in San Francisco. San Francisco, once again, not a good look. I mean, this is a man who's running for Senate, right? First of all, I would think that he would have security. I guess they don't stand by the car. But his bags ripped off in San Francisco. And I just think it's one of these things where it makes a headline and San Francisco does not look good. It's a message that we need to start trying to erase, making the city safer, right? Adam Schiff's bag stolen from his parked car. This is downtown San Francisco. The car was in a parking garage. The theft first reported by the Chronicle today. So he's speaking at a kind of fancy dinner party. And he's dressed in the only clothes he had, which is a navy long sleeve shirt, an olive vest, and a pair of gray pants. And I guess the photo that appeared in the Chronicle shows him in this kind of casual attire, speaking to groups of people in suits that are dressed more formally. He's at the dinner to thank Bay Area attorney Joe Cachet, who's supporting Schiff's bid for the Senate seat previously held by Dianne Feinstein. She, of course, died in September. And Lee Housekeeper, who is a press agent for Joe Cachet, says, I guess that's welcome to San Francisco, right? And the even crazier part of this is Adam Schiff had been warned not to leave anything in his car while it's parked in San Francisco. Doesn't that suck that that's the warning we have to give people? But Schiff says was in a real hurry and he didn't want to be late for his appearance at the dinner party. So I guess he leaves his stuff in the car, his bag in the car, and it's stolen. Stolen. He said he's taken this theft in stride. Yeah, he said they took my bags, but I'm here to thank Joe. So that's the way it is. Car burglaries are such a common thing in San Francisco. Like I always say, listen, if you like it, take it with you. If you like it, don't leave it in the car. If you want to keep it, you have to take it with you. I tell that to my kids, even in Petaluma, you know, if you've got a school iPad in your backpack and we have to run into Target for whatever reason, take all your stuff with you. Because if you leave it in the parking lot, and it's not even like San Francisco here in Petaluma, I mean, there's a chance that your stuff's going to get ripped off. But I just think it's a good mentality to always have that, you know, always know that if you leave it in the car, there is a chance that when you come back to the car, it's not going to be there. So, yeah. Poor Adam Schiff. I feel bad that he came to San Francisco and that's what happens. Damn it. Did you hear about these signs? I call them the whittle sign. I don't want to say they're fake signs because they're real signs, but they're not city sanctioned signs. No, they are not. This story out of SF Gate. These signs were put up by, I guess, a safety group. And they put up these signs because they think it's unsafe for bicyclists and pedestrians on the street of San Francisco. So they're trying to stop cars from speeding, or drivers from speeding down these streets that are popular bike routes. And they took matters into their own hands. You can kind of see, there's a video, and you can kind of see they have a flashlight. So they're going out at night and they're setting up these signs in the middle of the street. And they did it on Steiner Street between Waller and DuBose. It says yield to pedestrians and bikes, but they look a lot like official San Francisco Muni Transit Authority signs. I guess some cars have been hitting them because of where they're placed in the middle of the roadway like this. The group called Safe Street Rebel, that's the name of the group, Safe Street Rebel, they posted on X saying, "We are launching a new campaign to make the Wiggle San Francisco premier east-west bike artery safer for all. If you want to see the city install safe ped and bike infrastructure like this, use this one-click link to send an email to blah, 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 blah," and they have a link there. So I guess they've done similar things in the past. They are the people that put the traffic cones on autonomous vehicles, which causes them to stop, closing a turn lane at an intersection where a driver, I guess, hit a child with a car fatally. And the Muni SFMTA eventually closed that lane. Their unsanctioned signs are part of their campaign to make the Wiggle, about a mile-long bike route, more comfortable for cyclists. So it includes Steiner, and it zigzags from the intersection of DuBose and Market to right near the Panhandle. So they put up these signs, and the city of San Francisco did not like it, and they took them down along Steiner Street. Safety advocate group now wants their signs back. The group didn't have approval to install these signs in the middle of the road. They say the signs are needed to make the area known as the Wiggle safer, where cars and bicycles share the road for a mile. And of course, as I mentioned, the group is urging people to email the city. But the city came and took these signs down. They're like, "No, you can't do that." And the group is like, give our signs back. So now we have this fight between people trying to make the streets safer. I don't know if the streets are safer by putting up these signs, though. I mean, if drivers are flattening the signs with their cars, that's not safe for drivers either. And while I get that bicyclists and pedestrians are more at risk of injury because of the nature of the, you know, being open to the world, you're putting drivers at risk, too, by putting this crap in the middle of the roadway. That's not the way you go about things. So I get that they have the guerrilla tactics. I don't know if I like it. What do you guys think? I mean, I don't think they should be allowed to do that. No. Karen says you can get in legal trouble for putting up unofficial signs. Heather loves the signs people put up in her neighborhood saying, "Drive like your kids live here." I don't have any kids, so I guess that means I can floor it. And I was thinking about that because my sister has one of these. They live in a court, though. But they have one of these signs, or kind of, I guess, figurines that you get. I think they sell them at Costco or whatever. They look like a yellow caricature of a child right? With the kind of the legs in a running motion. And it's supposed to slow you down to warn you. Children are playing in the court. But I see them all over the place. And so is that any different than this? I think on a busy city street like this, there's a difference. Rather than putting one of those kid figurine signs at the end of a court, or even on your property, putting drive like your kids live here. I've seen those fastened to trees or to other things. And I think that's okay, but usually it's not in the middle of the roadway and it doesn't look like a city sanctioned sign. So, yeah. Heather says, it's low-key irritating when people put up fake signs in order to police others. I've seen signs on the side of the roadway that are handmade, that, you know, have different messages about, please slow down, next tree. On this road, next tree. Another message about how you should slow down. Whatever, it's fine. But don't try to pretend you're the city and make it official, right? Colleen says the fact that I'm doing this story is evidence that the protest works and their little sign thing. Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to talk about. I don't know. Heather says those signs are obnoxious. Maybe keep your kids out of the roadway instead. I will say I live on a street that's kind of, it's busy. It's the edge of a subdivision. So a lot of people have to drive down to get to the smaller streets. And people roar down this road that I live on. And it's annoying and I would love for them to stop. But yeah, I'm not going to put up a sign to say stop. What I did do is I put up a fence in my front yard. So it used to be grass then sidewalk. And now it's fence then sidewalk so that my kids can't chase a ball out into the street. And I know that people could still jump the curb and that it's dangerous in that way, but at least I have my people contained in here and they can't dart out into the roadway because there was a concern when they were younger. So that's the way it is. Okay, I have Tim Sika coming up, but I think I can get to this story that I wanted to tell you about because I made it the thumbnail for the show today. And this is a volcano in the Antarctic. And it spews gold. How crazy is this? Tiny crystals of gold, apparently worth $6,000 a day. That's what's happening. Gold raining from the sky. It's Mount Erebus, Erebus. And it's the southernmost active volcano on the Earth. It's a frozen continent, which features 138 volcanoes. 9 of them are active, including Mount Erebus. This Mount Erebus has a summit elevation of 12,448 feet. It's one of 3 volcanoes that form Ross Island, Ross, like the town of Ross. It's said that it was erupting when it was discovered back in 1841. And scientists are still observing this. They have an observatory up there. And they're looking for extreme life forms that can survive the frozen landscape, but also what's going on with this volcano in the area. So you have freezing and then hot right next to each other. The issue here with the interesting satellite images at the volcano reveal a lava lake. It's been bubbling since at least 1972. And this volcano regularly churns out plumes of gas and steam. It's been known to eject boulders, partially molten rock. They're called volcanic bombs. And so while these volcanic bombs are being shot into the air, also shooting into the air are bursts of gas spraying tiny crystals of metallic gold. They estimate this volcano kicks out about 80 grams of gold a day, worth about $6,000 a day if you were to go out there and collect it in this hot and freezing landscape. It's been found hundreds of miles away from Mount Erebus. They've detected traces of gold dust in ambient air up to 621 miles away from this volcano. So interesting. All right. I have Tim Seco waiting in the wings. And so without further ado, I would like you to help me welcome Tim Seco. We are at the movies with my friend. Hi, Tim Seco. How are you?
Hi, Kim. Boy, I'm wondering who gets to keep the gold from that volcano. Man, give me a piece of that, please. That'd be nice.
I think it'd be a little hard to collect it. But yeah. It feels like I should stand out there with a dish or something and try to collect the gold.
Really? Absolutely. Yeah.
So the first movie that you are going to review for us is Challengers, which is this sports relationship drama with Zendaya, right?
Yeah. Have you seen any of the trailers for this movie?
No, I just heard Michael Snyder talk a little bit about it, so I'm interested to hear what you have to say.
Oh, I'm interested in knowing what he like it?
He did. He thought Zendaya was amazing.
Okay, well, okay, all right, okay. I should probably start off by saying that I'm not the biggest Luca Guadagnino fan. He's the director of this movie.
Right.
I loathed Bones and All. I was in the minority over Call Me By Your Name, which I found appalling for a number of reasons, which people are tired of hearing me go on and on about. So I went into it with that bias. So I think you're going to hear a biased review. But yeah, you mentioned it. The movie stars and was produced by Zendaya. And it co-stars Mike Feist, who was he played Riff in West Side Story and Steven mm-hmm. Spielberg's West Side Story, and Josh O'Connor, who was in La Chimera, which we recently reviewed on the After Party. Anyway, it's a sweat and sex and sports relationship drama, and calling it a relationship drama is giving it way more credit than I think it actually deserves. And in it, Zendaya plays, and she is good. I agree with Michael on that. She's great. She's always great. But she plays this once famous tennis player who suffers an injury. And so she becomes a coach, right? Because she can't play anymore. And in various ways, she gets involved with best friends, Mike Feist and Josh O'Connor, who are also tennis players. And I think the way they're portrayed in this movie, closet homosexuals.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you know, The trailer makes you think it's about something else. And, you know, and what this movie claims to be about on its surface, I think it misrepresents what it's really about. I mean, that was my take on it. I mean, maybe I was just, I misread the trailer, but I thought it was going to be this hot and heavy, you know, menage a trois.
Right.
And it's really, I mean, it's more about these guys and their friendship. And there's all this like subtle homoeroticism, which I just thought was kind of creepy. Not because I find homoeroticism offensive, but it was because of the way it was portrayed. It's almost like the filmmakers wanted to have it both ways. I mean, you see male nudity in this. You don't see any female nudity in this. So that's weird. And anyway, I just found this movie characteristically sleazy. I found it prurient. I found it tawdry. I found it cheap. I thought it was puerile in its depiction of these three characters. The dialogue would be better suited to be coming out of the mouths of junior high school students than actual adults, for one. I mean, I had all kinds of issues with this movie, but I think I made my point. It also has this underlying pervy feel to it. I don't know.
I thought it was about them fighting over her.
I didn't get that.
Okay.
I mean, that's sort of like the excuse that was being used to really, I don't know. I just thought it was, I don't know. It was weird. I think, well, if you love sports and sweat and sex movies, I mean, although neither one of those is sufficiently served here, mm-hmm. You know, you might want to check it out. But, and maybe I don't know. I just have all these personal issues with Luca Guadagnino's movies. I don't think he's being on the up and up with filmgoers. But anyway, I didn't care for it. I thought it was, yeah. You know, to further annoy me. I know I'm beating a dead horse.
Bring it
on. The way it was filmed, the music scoring and the silly choral passages, the coded dialogue, the self-conscious stylization, it was so self-satisfyingly rendered, and it took itself so seriously that it's not even good camp. I think like Joe Esterhaus, you know, who wrote Showgirls, should have directed this. He should have had his hand in directing this. I probably would have liked it more, but I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, We'll start off by being negative and we'll end on positive this week.
Let's move to this one. This is Boy Kills World.
Yeah, you know, Kim, as evidenced by the John Wick movies and the recent Monkey Man movie and the remake of Roadhouse, these action movies are going totally off the rails in terms of them having to outdo their predecessors in the way of breaking bones and smashing heads and just being grotesquely violent. So this is one of those movies. Bill Skarsgård of the Skarsgård acting family, father Stellan, older brothers Alexander, plays the boy of the title. He plays a deaf mute. He's spiritually trained by this shaman who vows revenge on this fascist family running the country in which he resides. This is also a dystopian futuristic drama, a totalitarian hellhole, as it's described in the movie. He vows revenge on this totalitarian family, this government that this family runs, who murdered his sister and mother in one of their like killing sprees, you know, where they go out and kill people who don't agree with what they're doing. So it's a revenge story. It's a tale of vengeance. So you kind of know what you're going to be in for, right? Which is a lot of gore, a lot of grossness, a lot of martial arts fighting, where characters get so bashed around and banged about that in real life, after the third hit to the head, their body would go into total shock. And if the blow didn't do it, their body going into shock would. And of course, they would die right on the spot. But not these characters, not these people, not in these kinds of movies. So it's violence, violence, violence. Mm-hmm. It's fighting, fighting, fighting. And I never even thought that a cheese grater could be so effective in offing your enemies.
Oh God, no.
Yeah. So it's loud, it's crass, it's a little cheesy because it's got this bargain basement sounding narration. It's got a techno score, rock score, video game violence. I should also mention that it's a comedy, which is kind of funny. There's a Hunger Games kind of Squid Game feel to it too. It's stylish. The script's not bad. It's morally complicated. It's a crazy tongue-in-cheek nutball of a movie. Not something I would want to make a steady diet of, but for action fans who love super violent movies with the bloodiest of climaxes, Boy Kills World is definitely your catnip, I would say. And I kind of liked it. Although, I'm sort of getting my fill of these movies. It's sort of like, I want to break. It's like having superhero fatigue, only they are making so many of these violent movies that it's almost like you become desensitized. I'm becoming desensitized, and I don't want a steady diet of them. But objectively, I thought it delivered. I thought it was a good movie.
Okay. Hundreds of Beavers. You got me with the name.
Yeah, I'm late to the party on this movie, but I recently caught up with it. It reminds me again, man, how utterly and unabashedly creative movies can be when there seems to be a record of movies than ever being made, than ever before. And you know, you would think that, like, you know, everything's just going to be a retread. No, not this movie reminds me that you can still be creative, even though there's gazillions of movies being made today. And it's a weird and funny and endlessly inventive movie, Hundreds of Beavers. It's in black and white. It's a combination of live action and animation, and is in effect a silent movie. It's got lots of music and sound effects, of course, but there's no dialogue, virtually no dialogue. And the film's story is totally conveyed through its visual images. And again, it's another one of those movies being made today that, because it gets harder and harder to describe some of these movies, it makes you wonder if that could mean that these movies are getting better or they're getting worse. But in the case of Hundreds of Beavers, I would say better. Yeah. The plot is that this Applejack maker, who in order to win the hand of this woman he's very keen on, in exchange for her hand in marriage, he has to provide this woman's father, who is a fur trapper, with hundreds of beavers.
Okay.
So, and yeah, that's a simplified version of the plot. So it's wonderfully funny. It's creative. It's inventive. It reminds me of the Warner Brothers Looney Tunes. It has that kind of wacky energy and was no doubt influenced by those cartoons. I suspect the filmmakers were also big fans of the classic Buster Keaton silent movies. There's a quality about it too that reminded me of the early Walt Disney Alice in Wonderland cartoons. cartoon experiments with live action and animation, and the Mickey Mouse cartoons too, like Steamboat Willie. That's what it kind of looks like, those movies. The visual gags are just technically extraordinary. They keep topping each other. There's this chase sequence that you just go, my God, who could even conceive of this? It's so astonishing. And the whole movie is just dazzling and fun, and it's very different. I defy anybody who can tell me what movie they've seen recently that Hundreds of Beavers is even remotely like. So, yeah.
This is not what I would expect you to say about this movie, so that's cool.
I didn't even know what to expect, but I had heard that critics were going kind of gonzo over it, which always, like, you know, is like usually like a red flag. That means I'm either going to agree or violently disagree, but I'm in the agreement camp. I just think it's... I just highly and very enthusiastically recommend it. It's really a lot of fun. And it's one of those movies that gives you energy. You're watching it. You feel so good when it's over because it's so much fun. So
is it, is it kid friendly?
Yes. Okay. Well, you know, there's a there's some raciness, you know, with the woman that he's kind of like, I don't want to say lusting over, although he kind of is, but the woman that he's really keen on. I mean, there's some flirtation and stuff, which I don't know if would be appropriate for little kids, but you know, it again, that's a hard question for me to ask because I would let my kids pretty much watch anything that they were interested in. So I'm real liberal that way, but anyway, I don't know. It's up to the parent. I always say it's up to you. This is what it's about. You judge it. You make the decision for your kids. So,
all right. Okay.
Yeah.
This is an interesting title. How to explain your mental illness to Stanley Kubrick.
Well, that's what it is. I should qualify this a bit too and say that this movie may explain more than any other and in clear detail of what my personal taste in films is like. This is an essay film, Kim. It's written, produced, directed, and stars indie filmmaker Philip Yusuf Brubaker. And in a way, it's a documentary because it's documentary-like in some ways, but it's really more of what they call an essay film. And by essay film, I mean a movie that, well, in my opinion anyway, does more ruminating and contemplating and speculating about the subject or the subject in question, as opposed to its documentation of facts per se. Sure. And a movie that makes you look at its subject or themes or its theses in a different way. So in a way, essay films are like conversation starters. So the conceit here, I hope I can explain this because it's kind of meta in how to explain your mental illness to Stanley Kubrick, is that the director of the film, Phil Brubaker, who directed it, and another actor playing director Stanley Kubrick, right, are having a conversation wherein the director of this film, the real director of this film, Phil Brubaker, is showing Kubrick, as portrayed by this actor, scenes from movies that mean something to him, like Goodfellas and Close Encounters of the Third Kind and One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, with the computer from 2001, A Space Odyssey, HAL 9000, looking on. Trying to explain his mental illness to Stanley Kubrick and taking the director to task for misrepresenting the notion of mental illness as much of it is the way it's portrayed in Kubrick films. And very interesting side note here. This is either going to make people want to see this or it's going to make them want to run away from it. The director actually made this film while experiencing some sort of psychotic break. Really?
Wow.
I know. And I'm sure he won't mind me saying that because I think he said it in interviews. Mm-hmm. I don't know if moviegoers who are unfamiliar with Kubrick movies, the director of 2001 and The Shining and Clockwork Orange, among others, I don't know if they would enjoy this as much as I loved it because I'm a Kubrick fanatic. And but as an experimental film that not only celebrates the movies of Kubrick, but makes you look at mental illness in a way in which you may not have ever looked at it before, I'm unsure how it would go over with that audience, those unfamiliar with Kubrick films. But this audience of one, and Kubrick self-describes Kubrick fanatic, I thought it was great. And I think it's bold. I think it's brave because it's so personal. It's a naked film in the sense that the director really bears all. I just think it's brilliant. And I'm talking about it today, Kim, because I want to alert watchers. It's not easily seen, this film, but I want to alert watchers and listeners of the After Party that it will be getting this special screening at the Little Roxy Theater in San Francisco on Saturday. That's tomorrow, April 27th at 1:20 p.m. The director, Philip Brubaker, will be there in person. He's going to participate in a post-screening Q&A moderated by Bay Area filmmaker Jonathan Kiefer. And you just have to see this film, folks. Fans of Stanley Kubrick and intelligent and unique and original movies, it's a must-see. I found it sheer magic, this movie. And yes, it's a serious movie because it deals with mental illness, but it's also very funny. It has a wonderful sense of humor about itself. I loved it. So there you go.
You said Little Roxy Theater tomorrow, Saturday, April 27th. At what time?
1:20 p.m. And you can go get tickets by going on roxytheater.com. And it's real simple. You make a couple of clicks, and you can get tickets. And yeah, seeing it on the big screen, too, is an experience. And it's a rare experience because it hit the festival circuit, I'm told, a little while back, but it's not been widely seen. So, you know, San Francisco film goers, now's your chance to see it on the big screen. Yeah.
Wow. Okay. All right. Next up, we have, and the last movie of the day, Baby Reindeer.
That's well,
I was thinking this would be an animated film, but then I saw the picture and I'm like, oh, okay.
Well, you know, Michael Snyder is sort of inspiring me to go beyond films and maybe try a little TV. This is so hence this. But I also, a friend had told me about this. So this is a Netflix drama series. And staying on the topic of mental illness here, holy friggin' cow. This new Netflix drama series, Baby Reindeer, talk about turning your insides inside out. This is a riveting new show, and it's easily binged. That was the other thing that got me to say, okay, well, I'll try it, because it's 8 episodes, but most episodes, they average 30 minutes in length, so it's easily binged. I got through it in a snap. But it's an autobiographical based on a true story. It's a combination black comedy and a tragedy. It was created by and stars a Scottish comedian named Richard Gadd, who based this on his own play about his experiences of being stalked by this crazy woman and sexually assaulted in his early 20s.
Oh.
But it is superb. In addition to its riveting portrait of mental illness and how the one being stalked has some kind of connection, maybe, possibly, to the stalker. You know, its portrait of self-loathing is deeply powerful. The notion of us being ultimately responsible for our own well-being and personal welfare is blisteringly presented in this show. There's just a ton to unpack here when you watch it. And it's also about the power and the root healing force of being honest. You know, a lot of times, you know, people struggle with that. But this movie shows that, or this series shows that, you know, if you can cross that bridge and really get to the nitty-gritty and the truth of your life, you know, doors open. Anyway, this is it's very sad. It's shocking. It's strangely poignant. It's brilliantly acted, too. And for my money, it's the gold standard for creating compelling art out of personal experience. I don't want to say anything more about Baby Reindeer, except to say that if you can, listeners and watchers of the After Party, stop what you're doing and check this out. It's called Baby Reindeer. It's now streaming on Netflix, and you can write in and thank me later.
And you really loved it, even despite its kind of tough topic and subject matter.
Yeah, yes, I liked it because there's some humor in it too, but I kept watching it going, where are they going to take this? Where in the world is this going to go? And can it get any weirder? Apparently, everything you see in this drama is what this guy personally experienced. So, you know, that gives it an added layer of, I don't know, what is it? verisimilitude. What is that word?
I don't know. You know,
yeah, anyway, verisimilitude. Verisimilitude is the word. Yeah, okay. Yeah. Anyway, yeah, it's just...
Well, ding it, whatever it was, yes.
Not yet. Now, the third episode, it sags just a little bit, but it's a longer episode, but... I encourage people to stick with it because by the time it ends, you're just gobsmacked in a really, really good way. And this shows the power of film, you know, the power what film can do and how it can transport you and take. And, you know, you watch this thing and you go, man, I thought I had problems. Oh, man. compared to a lot of other people, my problems are teeny tiny in the scheme of things. Mm-hmm. You know, what some people go through, it just takes your breath away, you know?
Let's recap it. Challengers hated it.
You said hated it.
Was, hated it.
Hated it. Yeah,
you said it was horrible.
You
thought it cheapened the characters.
Oh, yeah.
You thought that they were just representing what they were trying to sell us
really
here.
Got it.
You weren't buying what they were selling.
No, I wasn't buying what they were selling.
Boy Kills World. You said it's violent. It's loud. It's crass. It's a little cheesy. Kind of funny, though. And if you like this kind of thing, you'll like it because you actually liked it.
Yeah, yeah. And it's usually, and actually it's usually not my cup of tea. So, yeah.
A surprise pick of the week. Hundreds of Beavers, this live action animation comedy. You said it's funny and creative and dazzling and fun. You liked it.
Yeah, I did.
Yeah. How to explain your mental illness to Stanley Kubrick. You said of this movie that it's an essay film and very documentary-like, and you liked it. You said it celebrates Kubrick's films and it makes you think about mental illness. And so if you're a person that's a fan of Stanley Kubrick movies, you'll probably enjoy this, even though it's weird.
Yes. It's different. Yeah. And it's weird. It's weird. I should qualify that. It is weird, but it's weird in a really good way.
Mm-hmm. And Baby Reindeer, speaking of weird, you said it's a weird but personal experience story, and you really love this series on Netflix, Baby Reindeer.
Yes. Very, very well summarized there.
So there
Tim
we
McAllister.
Have it.
Yeah.
Tim Sika, I love you for being on the After Party Live, and I always love your reviews. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. I always love talking movies with you, Kim. I actually should let you get a word in edgewise sometimes.
No. It's all about you. I want to hear what you have to say. People hear me enough. So this is good.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the opportunity in the forum. And
absolutely.
I love being on the show. And we'll talk to you next week, right?
All right. Sounds good. Okay, and I'll make sure that we separate your video and put it out as a separate. So if people are just looking for that, they'll be able to find it.
Thank you so much. Okay, have a good
weekend,
Tim.
Bye. Tim Sika, everybody. Love it. We have been at the movies with Tim Sika. There's my little slide for you. All right. I do have some time, so let's bring out some of these other stories that I was looking at. This one I think is really interesting, and I should tell you before we get into it that my grandfather, whom I adored, died of melanoma. I have the whitest skin you've ever seen in your life. If I step out into the sunshine, I turn bright red within 3 or 4 minutes. And then if I stay out, it's a sunburn. So I have to be really careful. So melanoma is a big concern. Again, runs in my family, and I'm not just white, I'm ultra, ultra white, okay? So this is an experiment done on this first personalized mRNA cancer jab for melanoma. They're testing it on patients in the UK. It is being called a game changer, not only for melanoma, but it has the potential to stop bladder, lung, and kidney cancer. It is custom built for each person and tells the body to identify cancer cells. And the whole point of it is to stop the disease from returning. A stage 2 trial found it significantly reduced the risk of cancer coming back in melanoma patients. And they call it, according to one of the co-investigators of the trial, so clearly someone with a vested interest in this experiment and this therapy, called it one of the most exciting things we've seen in a really long time. She said, and this is Dr. Heather Shaw, she said it's a finely honed tool. To be able to sit there and say to your patients that you're offering them something effectively like the fat duck at Bray versus McDonald's, it's that level of cordon bleu that's coming to them. She said these things are hugely technical, finely generated for the patient, and the patients are really excited about them. So here's how they do it. They create this personalized therapy meant just for your body. They take a sample from, if you happen to have whatever tumor, the sample is removed from the tumor, the DNA is sequenced. Artificial intelligence does play a role here. It's very much an individualized therapy, and they say it's a lot more clever than a regular vaccine in a lot of ways because it's custom built for the patient. They said you couldn't give this to the next patient in line because you wouldn't expect it to work for them. It's not tailored to their body. And she said there's real hope that these will be game changers when you talk about immunotherapy. The phase two trial of this found people with high risk of melanomas who got the jab alongside immunotherapy drug Keytruda were about half as likely to die or have their cancer come back after 3 years than those who just had Keytruda by itself. The phase three global trial will include a wider range of patients. They're trying to recruit about 1,100 people for this one. At this point, 60 to 70 patients across 8 UK centers are set to be recruited to test also for lung, bladder, and kidney cancer on this one as well. So it's this interest in cancer vaccines that has kind of been sparked in recent years by a better understanding by scientists of how the body controls immune responses, and also by the development of these mRNA vaccines, which makes developing a vaccine based on the immune profile of a patient's own tumor much more straightforward. It could be a game changer. So I wanted to make sure and mention that today because I saw the story and I was like, whoa, this is cool. Here's a wild story. This one, the story comes out of CNN. And here's the headline. A school principal faced threats after being accused of offensive language on a recording. Now police say it was a deep fake. This is affecting regular people. So the recording of this guy pictured here, he is the Pikesville High School principal, Eric Ellsworth. This is taken from a screenshot of Baltimore County Public Schools from 2019. But this recording of him went viral in January. And whatever he said here brought out rage. He'd been allegedly caught making racist and anti-Semitic comments. So the videos posted, angry phone calls come into the school. Employees at the school felt afraid. They had to bring in security. He is placed on administrative leave pending an investigation. There's threats of violence toward him. One person, according to the police, said the world would be a better place if you were on the other side of the dirt. He denied making the offensive remarks. He said it wasn't his voice on the recording. He said it has to be a fake. This wasn't me. And so today, law enforcement authorities announced they believe he's right. Now, mind you, the video, the deepfake video, came out in January. So he's been dealing with the backlash and repercussions from a video that wasn't even him for months. And now today, police say the recording was indeed a fake. And the man accused of making it, a school employee who had clashed with the principal. The man was arrested on charges that include disturbing the operation of a school. A Baltimore County executive saying, "We are relieved to have some closure on the origins of this audio. It's clear," they say, "we are entering a new, deeply concerning frontier." The athletic director, apparently responsible, his job was in jeopardy. the principal was investigating a potential theft involving the high school's athletic director. His name is Dazhone Darian. As unauthorized payment for about $2,000 had been made to Darian's roommate, who was a basketball coach for the school, under the pretense that the roommate had also worked as an assistant girls' soccer coach. But when the principal and a colleague looked into it, they found this purported assistant coach had never assisted during soccer season. So Principal Eiswirt confronts athletic director Darian about the payment, and Darian said it was a mistake. And this wasn't the first time these two had had a confrontation. The report said Darian previously fired a coach without approval, so Eiswirt asked other administrators to monitor Darian more closely. He'd spoke to Darian about the non-renewal of his contract, about performance challenges, you could put it that way, at work. And it seems like maybe this guy got really, really mad and put this deep fake together. Crazy. And it was apparently sent to other teachers. There's disparaging comments, including one about two teachers, about Jewish people, about Black students. Horrible. A teacher who didn't get along well with Principal Eiswirt admitted to sharing it with a student who knew, she knew, would rapidly spread it around social media. The teacher also sent the recording to media outlets and the NAACP because she didn't get along with the principal. So, somebody, they were wondering if secret recording devices were planted at the school. People were taking phone calls in their car instead of the school because they wondered what was going on here. So anyway, it's a deep fake. Total deep fake. Can you believe this? And this is the way that our world is going now. I guess this is what we have to look forward to. Is this type of, you don't know if a conversation is real. It could really look real, right? I mean, it could be like, you know, you believe it. I think we have to start thinking about the people we know and, you know, do we know them to speak this way? I don't know. Ways to test for things. I mean, it's easy for someone to go, I never said that. I didn't do that. But how will we really know now? And now we have to look at everything with a you know, very suspect pair of eyes. A little softer news for you. Nike has come out with this new shoe, new and better, ahead of the Paris Olympics. This new collection of elite footwear, it's called the Super Cycle of Innovation. They have this Nike Air cushioning technology they've developed in four new designs as part of a collection they're calling the Blueprint Pack. The Blueprint Pack. So the four different designs are the GT Hustle 3 basketball shoe, the 2024 Nike Mercurial football boot, the Nike Victory 2, and the Nike MaxFly 2 spikes for sprinting and middle distance track running. It's really interesting. It's got a double layer of Nike Air pockets. The Nike chief design officer said its increased energy return or bounce provided by the Nike Air will be the difference maker at this year's Olympic and Paralympic Games in July and August in Paris. He said the Olympics represents the biggest platform in sports. The athletes have been training all their lives to get ready for this. Being in the sports industry, designing sports equipment for footwear and apparel, it's the pinnacle moment. It's an amazing test for them, too. Lets them test every single time. Not only new products, new and better products, that will allow us to have an incredible platform to innovate and design the and put the best foot forward. So, that could be Nike advertising, or it could be that these shoes really do have increased bounce. And here's the question. If these shoes really have give you an edge and make you bounce more or springier, or I don't know. It's easier to run. You get more bounce and spring in your step. Then is it you or is it the shoe? Shouldn't all things be equal? Shouldn't maybe everyone have to wear the same shoe to see who really runs the fastest, who really plays the best basketball? Because if it's about who can afford the whiz-bang, new generation Nike Super Bounce, makes you faster, makes you fly higher, whatever shoe, then isn't that more about the shoe than you? Now, granted, put that shoe on me, I'm still going to suck at basketball, right? Put that shoe on me, I'm still not running down the track like an athlete. But again, all things being equal, that's the question. Is it the shoe or not? Walter says, I'd never spend that much for shoes. I don't know. Wes, don't do it. Wes says, I'll do that over the weekend. Make a deep fake voice of Kim and send her the video of her saying things. It depends. What are you going to make me say? I don't know. Deidre says, rescue teams. Oh, you're talking about, I don't know what you're talking about. Encourage her to swim out to the open ocean, according to the press release. I must have missed a story that you guys are talking about without me. I don't know. Oh, are you talking about I have a picture. Forget the shoes. You're talking about Brave Little Hunter. Or Deidre says, just in, the orca calf stranded in the British Columbia Lagoon for more than a month has swum out on her own. Oh my gosh, what great news. Although, I worry because they said she couldn't survive unless she met with her pod, right? Yeah, you're right. Deidre, thank you so much for the information and for the update on this one. This is great, great news. I'm so excited. Here's another picture of Brave Little Hunter. And here's the story. So excited to hear this because I've been rooting for this little one. Of course, backstory on Brave Little Hunter. If you haven't been following it, she's a 2-year-old orca calf that went into this lagoon off Vancouver Island, and her pregnant mother was stranded on a sandbar and died. And so she's been swimming around in there for a couple of months, and they've had all kinds of rescue efforts. Well, now, according to news outlets like CBC, Brave Little Hunter swam over a sandbar and on her own at high tide. So she's now free after swimming out on her own this morning. She swam over the sandbar and out into open water during high tide at about 2:30 early this morning, Pacific time. After a long night of feeding and watching the calf play in the lagoon, Ahatsat First Nation representatives said a small group stood as witnesses to watch her swim under the bridge and down the inlet. And this, they're celebrating this. And so am I. I'm feeling so elated. I don't know why I'm so attached to this story. They said people are waking up to incredible news, what can only be described as pride for the strength this little orca has shown. So she's been stuck there since March 23rd, and now she's free. I worry, and I'm glad that they didn't have to scoop her up in a sling, which is what they were talking about, to take her to the open ocean, because I think that's very stressful. But I'm so happy she's free, but I worry about whether she's going to find her pod or not, because they said if she doesn't, then she won't survive. So they were going to put her, remember, in this open pen, or this pen where that had been used to farm salmon, until her pod came by, and then set her free so she could meet up with them. So I don't know if that's going to happen. They say, yeah, primarily that she's overcome significant hurdles, but she needs to be reunited with her pod. If she's able to find her pod, then they're very sure she'll be adopted by her family members. So rescuers are trying to limit their contact with her so she doesn't become dependent on humans, even though she's been surrounded by us for the last few weeks. I really hope that she makes her way back to her pod. We'll keep following the story. Deidre, thank you for bringing that to my attention. I'm so happy to hear it. What a great way to end the show on a Friday. I don't think I have any other news that's as good as that, honestly. Yeah. Karen says, it's a cute whale, a sad story, seemingly hopeless situation. Yeah, no wonder I got wrapped up in it. Well, this is better. Yes, she can. Wes, they did see her eating in the lagoon. One would think that maybe if she could eat in the lagoon, then she could eat in the open ocean. So there is that. I don't know how she'll find her pod. I mean, the sound carries, right? So if they hear her cries, maybe out in the open ocean, if she hears them, I don't know. I'm hopeful. I don't know how that's going to work. So it might be harder to get updates now that she's free in the open ocean. That's true. Maybe she did hear her pod and that's what moved her to swim out. I like the way you think, Wes. Teacher Lori says she can call to her pod and they'll probably respond. She'd been calling from the lagoon, but that's different. So I'm hopeful. I really hope she makes it back. All right. Good news. Good news on this Friday afternoon. And thanks for being here. I do want to put out an immense thank you to everyone who has helped to support this show. And I know it's hard because everyone has their money out or hand out for money, right? But the show won't survive unless it's crowdfunded. And so I have this huge aloha. These are the folks that have contributed to the show just this week. That's James and Sue Ann, Nancy, Joyce, Wes, and Roger. Thank you this week for contributing to the show via the PayPal link found in the show description and in the About section here on YouTube for the After Party Live. Really couldn't do it without you. You allow me to continue doing what I love to do and to spend time with you and hang out. So huge thank you. Again, James, Sue Ann, Nancy, Joyce, Wes, and Roger. Big, big aloha. Big Friday love to you. We'll be back next week, not only on the Nikki Medoro show, but on the Mark Thompson show. Mark's still off, so Hal Rudnick will be back along with me. And I'm not sure if we're going to have True Crime Corner. We'll have something really good planned for you, though. And then we're back here on the After Party Live as well at 1 o'clock or 1:10 or 1:15 or whenever the Mark Thompson show ends. I'll try to do it a little bit more on time. Thank you for being here. Thank you for participating. And again, to Deidre, thanks for the update on that story. Really, really appreciate it. Walter says, yeah, thanks for lifting my heart. Absolutely. Thanks to Deidre for that as well. Again, have a great weekend. Make it a really good one. And I'll see you back here on Monday on YouTube. For now, bye everybody.
The After Party Live would like to thank the following contributors and viewers like you.